This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca, iTunes, and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
There was 8 of them who swarmed her and started kicking and punching Rena. 2 of the ones involved in the initial attack took her down on the other side of the bridge, and they continued to attack her. They dragged her to the gorge waterway and they drowned her. If Rena had one friend there that night, one friend that was true and genuine, things could have been very different.
So if you see something wrong is happening, your gut feeling tells you something is wrong, please do something about it. Don't be afraid. You see, notice something is wrong, do something about it actively. That can save a life.
Bullies thrive on you keeping quiet. That's how they get their power, if you don't talk about what's going on. So I can't stress that enough. If there's a problem you're having, talk about it. And don't just talk to each other. Talk to either your parents, a teacher, a counselor. Talk to adults, because they can help you deal with that problem. It's too big for you guys to handle on your own.
That was audio from the 2009 documentary, The Rena Virk Story. Suman and Manjeet Virk appeared in that film and have also shared their stories with many school and community groups over the years, since the murder of their daughter Rena by a group of teenagers in November 1997. We're speaking with a number of Canadians today who have been involved with restorative justice, and we're joined on the phone by Manjeet Virk.
Welcome back to People First Radio, Manjeet.
Thank you.
Manjeet, 6 girls ages 14 to 16 were sentenced in 1998 for their roles in the initial beating of Rena. Warren Glowatsky, who was 17 at the time, was convicted of second-degree murder a year later. Kelly Ellard stood trial 3 times in connection with Rena's death, and the Supreme Court of Canada upheld her 3rd conviction of second-degree murder in June 2009. What were your initial thoughts about the involvement of these people and their involvement in ending Rena's life?
Well, this group was out of control, especially Kelly Ellard and Warren Glowatsky. They had a lifestyle where they would routinely beat other kids up, and they used to have substance abuse, and routinely they will bully people. And in the school system, principal and the teachers knew had their disposition, but they were really stuck. They couldn't do much with them. So these kids just kept bullying people and eventually killed our daughter as well.
What happened in the fall of 2005 when you came face-to-face with Warren Glowatsky?
That was the most difficult part in my life, where I had to make a decision that do I want to see a person who has killed my daughter? But instead of thinking about myself and my feelings, I started thinking about him, that what he needs now. I saw him as a young person who is lost. He doesn't have parents to support him. He grew up in a very bad situation, went from place to place. And I realized that a young person needs some direction. And if we reject him at this time, perhaps he could be redeemed now. So we decided to see him, and thought that if we can help him go in the right direction, and if he can make some changes in his life and be a useful member of society again, it's worth while goal for us. So it was difficult, but we wanted to see what he has to say, and that's why it was very emotional time when I saw him. He was crying, and he was sobbing, and he really felt bad that what he did. And I think that was a consolation to us, that at least he is not hardcore. He has a conscience, and he wants to change. So it gave us the hope that our going there, it might ease some of his guilt now, and he can do better in his life.
Tell us about restorative justice and what it means to you, what it means in your life now.
Well, when it was introduced to us, although the damage is so severe that nothing can compensate it, restorative justice helped us to check our feelings for these people, especially for Warren, and it helped us to change our views towards him, because in a traditional way we thought he's a horrible person, I didn't want to see him. But when there was the opportunity to see him face to face, I got to know him a little bit more. I knew that he made a terrible mistake. He can never undo it. The damage is permanent. But at least there was the opportunity for him to say sorry and apologize. And I think that is a big step. When somebody makes a mistake and if they're willing to apologize and correct it, and they really, really are sorry for the things they have done, then you know that there is some hope for these people. On the other hand, if a person is defiant, they don't want to see the victim, they have their own opinions about the justice system, and they become incorrigible, then I think there is no hope for those repeat offenders.
I understand that there was a parole hearing for Kelly Ellard in February 2011. Were you at that parole hearing?
Actually, what we found out is that she did not apply for that parole hearing. We got the notice from Abbotsford Parole Board that this hearing will take place. But later on, it was recanted because she had not applied for it. She automatically came eligible for that hearing, so they thought she will take it, but she did not do it this time. So in another 2 years, she will be eligible again.
Now, what do you think will happen with restorative justice in Canada, given that the federal government seems to prefer punishment and incarceration, particularly at this point in time?
You know, they have their reasons for that, because when they see young people, and especially people, those who are repeat offenders, and they are not learning the lesson, and society is getting fed up with the crimes, so people think that increasing the sentence or getting tough on them is the answer, which is not quite right and true, because if that was the case there, then United States should have their system should have worked by now. But we can see that their jails are also bulging, and although they have severe penalties, but still they cannot have a handle on the crime. But on the other hand, restorative justice is not for everybody. If somebody is a repeat offender, serious crimes over and over again, and they don't want to change, then restorative justice is not for them. It's for somebody who has done something wrong and recognizes the damage they have caused, and they want to make things better at an early stage. And it has to be from their heart. They have to be willing to take advantage of this program. Nobody has to force anyone. Otherwise, people will say, that's an easy way out. I can use this program and get out. But that's not the case. Because for any crime, they have to go through the punishment. They have to go through the trial has to run its full course, and they have to get incarcerated, everything. It's later on, if they want to live with themselves, if they want to make things better for their own peace of mind, and if they are thinking of the victims, they could always take advantage of this program, which is very positive. It's good for public relations, it's good for healing, and it's good for their own spirit.
Manjeet Virk, is there anything else you'd like to add to our conversation today?
Well, you know, I like to say that it's really a difficult time for parents. Especially in November is coming now, and, you know, it reminds us of our tragedy. It's a difficult time for parents to raise kids because our young people have so much pressure as well. And stress is mounting on families, and all parents can do is be the good role models for their kids, spend time with them, and hope that your kids will go in the right direction. And for kids, the message is that listen to your parents. Do things with your family and don't squander your time on drugs and other activities, especially with young people. Go out drinking and binge drinking. All it does is brings grief and pain, and it doesn't result anything good. So stay clear of all the wrong things. Life is precious, and they should use it for the good cause. They can do volunteer work. They can do something healthy in the community rather than getting involved with bullying and violence and watching video games and listening to debased music. So the choices they have to make have to be healthy.
Manjeet Virk is a leader in the field of restorative justice. His book, Rena, A Father's Story, can be found online at Amazon.ca. In a moment, Anne-Marie Hagen's 56-year-old father, Thomas, was murdered in front of her by a mentally ill neighbor wielding an axe. Anne-Marie experienced her own personal trauma and pain after the murder, but she eventually became a passionate leader in the field of restorative justice. We'll be right back.
This is People First Radio, only on CHLY 101.7 FM and streaming at chly.ca.
Anne-Marie grew up in the fishing village of Kingman's Cove on the southern shore of Newfoundland. Hers was a happy childhood. She was fortunate to have a loving mother and a father whose world revolved around his family. On August the 12th, 1979, Thomas Hagen, her beloved daddy, was taken from her in a most horrific way. It was Sunday afternoon, and Anne-Marie, her siblings, and parents had just finished eating when a young man from next door dropped in.
We just finished our dinner. He walks in with the axe. He attacks my father. I'm standing back, and I remember shaking my head. I can't believe what I'm seeing. Within 3-4 minutes, it's all over. We never live in the house again. We leave this community. Everything changed. Everything that was sure to us was changed.
On that terribly dark day, there was no thought of forgiveness. Anne-Marie and her family had suffered an unspeakable loss. As time passed, she appeared to move forward. She went to nursing school, became a nurse, and got married. But inside, she saw the world from the perspective of a victim. From the perspective of a girl who witnessed the death of her father in the most violent way possible and who had been attacked herself and escaped death. From that day forward, Anne-Marie was transformed from a sweet, innocent young woman into an unhappy, bitter person.
That was audio from a 2007 short documentary called An Unexpected Peace. Anne-Marie Hagen appeared in that film, and she has shared her story with groups of people both inside and outside prisons since the murder of her father, Thomas Hagen, by a mentally ill neighbor in August 1979. We're speaking with a number of Canadians today who have been involved with restorative justice, and we're joined on the phone now by Anne-Marie Hagen.
Welcome to People First Radio, Anne-Marie.
Thank you, Kevin.
Anne-Marie, you write that after your father's murder, you became consumed by anger, vengeance, self-pity, and bitterness. Tell us about that time.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the first thing, you're struggling to understand how something like this could happen. And the vengeance, I felt that, well, he deserved to be locked up forever. And the way my mind worked is that the longer he was detained, the greater recognition there was of our suffering. The greater the recognition it was of my father's life, how important he was and how he shouldn't be murdered. And he had to pay.
What happened on June the 7th, 1996?
Well, first of all, in April, we got a call from a police officer telling us that government were secretly trying to sneak him out without our knowledge. And I started to prepare for a campaign to stop his release, and I had no doubt that I could. I had an autopsy report with 16 axe cuts described in detail, and who really wants an axe murderer on the street? So my mind was I couldn't lose. June 7, 96, we met with him, my mother, my two sisters, and I. And what I met was a very fragile, tortured human being. I had never thought of him before this meeting as anything other than an ex-murderer. And in the 17 years in between, I'd become an aunt. And I realized in that meeting that if one of my nieces, God forbid, were to kill somebody, I'd want them given the chance to start over. He answered one of my questions. I wanted to know if he remembered killing my father, and I didn't think he would because he was psychotic at the time, but he did remember fully. And then I realized what he was living with, the same thing I was living with, but through the years I'd been given all the love and support and kindness and encouragement. He, on the other hand, had been the subject of blame and shame and ridicule. And it was only his immediate family and his caregivers he had, but I had the whole world. Everybody is slapping you on the back and don't give up and everything will be fine. And I realized that off the two of us, while I wouldn't have chosen this experience, I was the blessed one. My role was far easier than his, because what we often forget when a person commits a violent crime, they do have a life sentence whether they're inside or out. It's very hard for them to blend in, find work, find housing, make friends. And, you see, us human beings, that's something I learned in forgiving him. I learned that I had been very hypocritical. Like most people, we want mercy for us and who we love, but we tend to throw other people away. And one of my greatest lessons in this experience was that I don't have the right to demand more from others than I'm willing to show to them. In other words, if I would want one of my nieces, and now I have a nephew, if I would want one of them shown mercy and kindness, well, that's what I must show to others. There can't be any difference in that equation. What I expect, I must show. And it's, you know, he's rebuilt his life since 96. He's doing well. He's found work as a result of the psychiatric hospital that he was in, as a program sponsored by them. He's attending university. I consider him very brave and very courageous to even want to leave the hospital after 17 years of being detained. You can imagine the learning curve. And he's doing well. I wouldn't tolerate any discrimination against him, and what I mean by that is if I turned on the TV this evening and someone was discriminating against him because he lives on their street, if he's a threat to public safety, that's fine. But if it's discrimination for the sake of discrimination, I will be on the next evening. And you see, us victims slash survivors have immense power in these scenarios. But with that power comes the responsibility to do the right thing. Now, forgiveness is not permission. I don't agree or condone what he did. But for me, forgiveness is taking the judgment out, taking the vengeance out, and looking at the situation objectively. That takes a lot of time. But I learned through this that the longer you carry someone, the heavier they get. He controlled my whole life. I was totally consumed with him, keeping him detained. All the scheming in my mind, when they tried to release him, who would I contact, who would I go to? And now, well, I'm free. I no longer have that responsibility. And we both have our lives back, him and I. It's been an incredible experience. I wouldn't have chosen it again. And I think one of the challenges for all of us is to, when the bottom falls out, and inevitably does for all of us, it might be an ex, but it falls out, look for the lessons. What can we learn? And to try and continue to see the joy in this world despite the devastation. And to realize trauma doesn't have to be a life sentence.
Tell us more about restorative justice, generally speaking, and where it's at in the country right now, given the current government orientation toward punishment.
Well, first of all, when we met with the man who murdered my father in 96, restorative justice wasn't something that was in Newfoundland. They invited us to a meeting with him to more or less put out a fire to stop me from what I was doing to co-opt us. But the present situation, I find the government, well, they tell us what's easy and easy to understand. You know, lock them up longer. I think they're scared that if they promote restorative justice, they may be seen as soft on crime. They realize that to promote it, they will have to engage in an extensive education campaign for Canadians. And to do the other thing is easier, lock them up and lock them up longer. It keeps people on side. The average person thinks that they're safer.
What have you heard from people that you have spoken with and met in all of your travels and the presentations that you've given? What is the feedback that you've heard from people? Are there many people out there who share the experience that you've been through?
Yes, I've met many who've been victims of violent crime, and they realize, too, that, you know, restorative justice helps reduce the likelihood that an offender will reoffend. And also, in my time in Canadian prisons, and I've been doing this since 07, you know, I meet offenders that show great remorse. Nobody is proud of what they did. And they speak about their victims, about making amends and realizing the harm they've done. And, you know, we talk about offenders. They're ordinary people, you know. And we got to remember that society is not served by continuing to persecute someone. Persecution of another doesn't help humanity in any way. And another lesson is that another person's lack of humanity cannot make us forget our own humanity, that we must try and salvage people, give them the chance to start again, and to make a meaningful contribution to society. But, you know, locking them away for longer periods of time in overcrowded prisons doesn't help our society.
Anne-Marie, is there anything else you'd like to add to our conversation today?
Just to encourage everyone that when they find themselves, well, maybe hating somebody or a group that they disagree with, stop and think, if that were me, or if that were someone I love, how would I want them to be treated? And remember to try and show to others what we expect for ourselves and who we love. That's the challenge. And to stop throwing people away. Remember, you know, we all are accountable for what we do and to serve our sentence and to pay our debt to society, but to give people the chance to start again. Give them the chance to be the best human being they can be. Because remember, people will rise or fall to our expectations of them. And everybody is somebody's child. Even the worst offender is still somebody's child.
Anne-Marie Hagen shares the story that changed her life and helps others to understand restorative justice in presentations across Canada. You can find Anne-Marie Hagen online at annemariehagen.com.
This is People First Radio, only on CHLY 101.7 FM and streaming at chly.ca.
The federal government's emphasis on incarceration and punishment in response to crime has created concern that restorative justice approaches are being pushed to the background. The government describes restorative justice as one way to respond to a criminal act, but a former federal ombudsman for victims of crime say that in reality, there is no interest from this government in restorative justice. What does this mean for the future of restorative justice in Canada?
We're speaking today with three people who have experienced and studied restorative justice, Manjeet Virk, Anne-Marie Hagen, and Evelyn Zellerer. Manjeet Virk's daughter, Rena, was murdered by a group of teens at age 14 in Victoria, British Columbia. Anne-Marie Hagen's 56-year-old father, Thomas, was murdered in front of her by a mentally ill neighbor. Both Manjeet Virk and Anne-Marie Hagen eventually came into direct contact with the killers of their loved ones and became, over time, articulate and passionate leaders in the field of restorative justice.
Evelyn Zellerer holds a PhD in criminology, is a restorative facilitator, consultant, and speaker, as well as a part-time instructor at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. Evelyn has seen that restorative justice offers much greater creativity in determining what needs to happen for amends and making things right, even with serious crimes like assault and murder.
Evelyn Zellerer joins us on the phone today. Welcome to People First Radio, Evelyn.
Thank you.
Evelyn, tell us about what you've seen. What potential does restorative justice hold?
Well, restorative justice holds tremendous potential, as we've just heard from two very powerful cases, and I want to thank Manjeet and Anne-Marie for sharing, because we often don't consider restorative justice for serious violent offenses, and these are two of the most violent, horrific crimes that have occurred in Canada, and so it speaks for itself, you know, just how powerful restorative justice is. So I see tremendous potential for all kinds of crimes and all kinds of individuals and cases, from, you know, the less serious conflicts that occur all the way up to the most serious crimes.
Restorative justice seems to be overshadowed by punishment approaches, particularly in this day and age. Tell us more about that dynamic and that continuum.
Yes, I'm one of the restorative practitioners that's concerned about the Harper's new crime bill that he's trying to push through. The best adjective of that crime bill is what we would call get tough. And so we have a political climate from the conservative government in Canada that is get tough, and I do have deep concerns about that for a variety of reasons, and I think one of them is just looking at the evidence. So when we look at you know, harsher punishments, we know that that's taking Canada down a path that is very problematic. So we can look to the United States and see what that has produced, and we see tremendous overcrowding. We still have high crime rates. We have huge financial strains. So the Supreme Court in the United States has ordered California to release thousands of prisoners just to try to deal with this situation. So I question the wisdom of the federal government to want to have more prisons, mandatory sentencing, and those kinds of get-tough policies when they've been proven empirically and also just by the actual reality of what's transpired in other jurisdictions, that it's not effective. And on the other hand, we have tremendous research showing the effectiveness of restorative justice as an option to dealing with crime.
You've said that restorative justice isn't an easy way out. It's a very difficult process. Why is it difficult, and how does it change people?
Well, restorative justice, one of the myths that I come across over and over again is people assume that it's, quote, soft on crime, and that couldn't be further from the truth. And I just invite people to consider in their own lives when they have done something wrong, if they've hurt somebody, you know, what is the hardest thing to do? And really the hardest thing is to face the person that you've hurt and to listen to them and what they've experienced. So for offenders to sit beside and across from their victims and the victims' families and supporters and their own peers and family and often justice officials, and to really hear the impact of their behavior and to really face what they've done and to be invited to take full responsibility is absolutely not an easy thing to do at all. And there has been cases where offenders had said, I'd rather not do restorative justice. It's too hard. I'd rather just go to court, and because they can stand behind their lawyer and they never have to face the reality of what they've done.
You wrote an article about, or an opinion piece about, the hockey violence and the riot in Vancouver in the spring, and you spoke about restorative justice in that context, I believe. Tell us more about that.
Yes. You know, I was in Vancouver at the time. It was horrific, and I, like many people, you know, it was awful, you know, to see our city burn and to just see thousands of, especially young people, involved in just horrific violence, and just it was terrible. And I realized that this is a perfect situation for restorative justice, because we have numerous people that need to take responsibility for what they've done. They need to be held accountable in a meaningful way. They need to get the impact of their behavior, and we absolutely need to support those who were harmed. And there's been many, many victims, awful stories of people who were in these stores that were being looted, and you can only imagine the terror that they went through. A friend of mine was in a building, and they were locked inside because there were fires going on outside. So imagine what it's like to be locked inside a building when there's fires that you can see outside the window. And the list goes on and on and on. So we need support for the victims in terms of their own healing. And the whole community was affected. And so we need to have healing at a community level. The criminal justice system is important. It serves a very important purpose in our society to determine legal guilt and legal innocence, for example. We have due process. We have legal rights that must be upheld. It is not so good at other things. So the justice system isn't set up to build community. It is not set up for healing. And restorative justice is. So this is a great example where we can hold these young people accountable in a meaningful way. We can support the victims in their healing, and we can move forward with building our community and reclaiming the reputation and the impact of these riots. So I'm arguing that this is a great place for restorative justice to play a role alongside the criminal justice system.
What's next for restorative justice in Canada in what you might call the lean years for this type of approach? What do you think will happen over the next few years?
Well, my hope is, and my work is, to have restorative justice implemented across communities in all the provinces and territories. So restorative justice is here. We're going to be doing it. It's proven over and over again to be powerful, and so we will be doing restorative justice. It's just a matter of within what context. So if we have a political context that is not supportive or does not provide the necessary resources, it's going to be very difficult for us in Canada to do restorative justice. On the other hand, if we have the political will and we have resources that are provided, for example, core funding, then we will be able to do restorative justice in a much more powerful way. So we are facing a decision right now in Canada, and so I ask, you know, do we want to create a country where it's an eye for an eye? Do we want to be a punitive, get-tough country where we declare war on those who make very bad choices? Or do we want to create a society where we hold people accountable in a meaningful way, we support victims in their healing, and we strengthen our communities? It's up to us now.
Evelyn, is there anything else that you'd like to add to our conversation today?
Well, there's always so much to say. I just want to say this works. You know, it's common sense if we really think about it. We're just asking people to use their common sense in terms of crime and justice and not to get caught up in the appeal of a get tough, because that's just too politically convenient to say, let's get tough on crime. And it's very hard to say, oh, well, let's not get tough. And it's not about get tough or not get tough. I argue it's about getting smart on crime.
Evelyn Zellerer is a restorative facilitator, consultant, and speaker, as well as a part-time instructor at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. You can find Evelyn online at peaceofthecircle.com.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with the Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.